Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are in the world. Thank you for joining me for this week's edition of the SMIE Consulting Midweek Roundup. I'm your host, Marty Bennett, and today on the Roundup, our 101st edition of the Midweek Roundup. It's amazing that it's been over 2 years now since we started the Roundup, and looking forward to continuing to have these conversations with you each week as we dive into some of the key issues that are affecting our field of international education. For those that are new to the Roundup, this is our opportunity each week to come to you and chat about some questions that we've been hearing from other international educators this past week. And we want to dive into those and some of the news stories that have come out and have impacted how we look at these issues and are framing the way we look at some of these issues. And we'll get to those questions in just a minute, but before we do, I want to give a special welcome to all of you who are joining live here on Facebook. It's always a pleasure to have the interactions with you on this platform, but also those who can't catch us live, and we know that's not a possibility for everybody, watching us on repeat on Facebook or on our YouTube channel, it's great that you're catching the content when you have that time. And also those that have been podcasting, loyal podcast followers for since we started the Midweek Roundup. I want to say thank you for making us a part of your listening journey each week. So thanks for subscribing to our podcast on either iTunes, Google Play, Podbean, Spotify, or Stitcher, or whatever your favorite platform is. We're glad that we could be a part of your journey. If you're wondering where the news stories that we discuss each week are coming from, we do make these parts of our newsletter service, our free newsletter service to international educators. And it's a service we've been offering for almost 2 years now, this coming October. And it's a way for us to share what we're doing with you as fellow international educators, and a way to help put into a digestible format all of the major news stories that we found out in on the ether about our field and about how we are really how we can really make these stories and adapt these stories to our own institution's policies, and really hope that they can be of value to you. But these the newsletter again comes out Monday morning 9 a.m. Again, it's a free service to anyone who has who would like to subscribe. Just go to smieconsulting.org/subscribe. At the top of the page will be the link to enter your email address and other details so we can get you on that mailing list. We take three of the stories that we find from those from our newsletter, all the SMIE news fit to share, and go into more depth with here on the Roundup each Wednesday. Now, what we're going to start with today is the question of why TikTok and WeChat have suddenly raised this administration's ire and have been a target now of President Trump for the last couple of weeks. He's made it clear that he sees TikTok and WeChat, TikTok, the short-form video sharing platform that is a Chinese product, Chinese-owned, Chinese-developed, Chinese-backed. And also WeChat, which is the most popular social platform in China, and one that's essential for students and students once they get to the United States to communicate, but also how people do everything beyond just social media. This is where they shop. This is where they pay how they pay their bills, develop conversations and those types of things. So very, very important platforms that are both China backed. The basis for the potential ban, and much like everything that this administration does, there's a game of brinksmanship being played here, particularly when it comes to our relationship with China. There's always been kind of a push something out there and see if it sticks, and much like the immigration regulations we've talked about in the past that the administration has thrown on against the wall to see if any of them stick or really develop a huge backlash like last month's DHS action regarding online studies for continuing students. That obviously didn't work. There have been other things that have been tried by this administration over the last few years, particularly in relation to our relationship as a country with China, that have backfired, and some have worked, some have not. This is a part of the larger game that this administration is playing. First story from the New York Times talks about why those two are in its crosshairs of the administration. And they're important for international educators, obviously, WeChat being an essential tool to reach Chinese students abroad. We've talked about that in the past here on the Roundup. We'll have another couple stories about that in a minute. But TikTok is that new video sharing platform that's popped in the last couple of years, and U.S. institutions have started using that not only for domestic but also increasingly international recruitment initiatives. And aren't too many great examples of that TikTok use internationally yet, but that's increasingly becoming a focus of institutions as a way to reach students where they are and in on platforms that they're spending time on. And TikTok certainly fits that bill. The administration is saying that both of these platforms are, because of their China backing, are ones that in the United States should be potentially banned because of national security concerns. And these platforms being used as a way for the Chinese government and or Chinese entities to impact the larger U.S. Population, and in terms of whether it's upcoming elections or other things about policy or soft power initiatives from China. However, from the federal government perspective, that's how and why these two platforms are being targeted for potential bans. Now, basically, the government put a 45-day clock on them. You may have heard that Microsoft has been in talks to potentially purchase TikTok and to make it a U.S. owned body. That's not necessarily going to happen yet, but they're in talks to make that happen. And they've acknowledged that if talks do go through and they do acquire TikTok, that they would address the concerns, the national security concerns, safety concerns that the current administration has regarding the application TikTok. WeChat, not sure if that is going to have the same legs. Obviously, WeChat is a much different, much broader application that has uses in China. It's almost omnipresent in terms of the impact that it has. And for those that are looking to find out more about WeChat, those who know Karen Fisher at The Chronicle, she has done her own, has been running her own weekly newsletter for the last few months. And the last edition that came out this past Monday was entitled The WeChat Edition. And she talks about the impact this would have for Chinese students, not only prospective students in China, and wouldn't have necessarily a direct impact on them from a U.S. standpoint. They would still be able to access it in China, obviously, but it would impact current Chinese students and faculty and families that are in the United States if they were no longer able to use WeChat to communicate with loved ones back in China or to have the kind of conversations and do the kind of functions that they use the platform for currently. So it's really interesting to see where that goes on the WeChat side. It has that one more than any other would have more far-reaching implications as it impacts international education than perhaps TikTok. But certainly WeChat for current international students from China here studying, that would be a significant concern to them if they're no longer able to access that platform. They may be looking at, oddly enough, Westerners go to China and want to access Facebook, YouTube, they have to have their own VPN, or even Chinese citizens in China who want to access Western platforms like YouTube, Facebook, that type of thing. They need a VPN to do that. You may see a rise in Chinese students using VPNs to be able to access WeChat or to use WeChat if it's from a server outside the United States, if this does go through. So very interesting to see what happens on that. But this week's edition of the SMIE Consulting e-newsletter, Social Media and International Ed Consulting, a newsletter is normally much more heavily weighted to international ed stories and social media stories. But this week we actually switched it up, and we had these social media stories. And there was probably at least 10 stories that we focused on in Monday's newsletter that shows just how important social media has become and the relevant ancillary parts of virtual recruitment in what we do in international education. So definitely some great resources out there, and the articles I'm posting the links to on the Facebook page are ones I'd certainly encourage you all to give a look to as you look to get some broader perspective on what's going on with these social media issues, particularly as it relates to China. One company that we've talked about here on the Roundup before that is exclusively focused on the China market and providing access for Western universities into China is Synorbis. And Synorbis really allows a couple things. Allows institutions to develop a digital presence in China. And a lot of my colleagues, when I talk to them about this, their eyes kind of glaze over if they're not techie. They don't necessarily get the functionality and the necessity to have locally hosted web-based services in China that you have can control from here. And whether it's your website or access to Chinese social media platforms, these have become increasingly necessary pieces of international student recruitment when you look at U.S. and other Western universities that are trying to get to Chinese students and parents. So companies like Synorbis make the case that if you want to reach those markets, you need the expertise on the ground, you need locally hosted sites. There are other companies that do locally hosted sites. IDP Connect has been doing that through their Hot Courses platforms for years, having Chinese language versions of university content locally hosted in China. With Synorbis, they do something very similar. They have a website, that website builder that's very easy, and you can put your own couple to five, ten important pages of your website together, have them translated into Mandarin and available that content locally hosted in China. You can put a site together with a version of your site together within 10, 15 minutes and a really, really rough version of it, but you can get the basic content in there and translate it in there. So that's a service that can really add value because the load times, and this matters when it comes to your website functioning in China, because you may have pages of your website that have been translated locally or are translated into Mandarin that are locally hosted on your website, on your servers in the United States. But the load times for those sites in China, those same sites in China, even though it's Chinese language content, makes the load times almost unwatchable unwatchable for Chinese audiences. That it would take too long to get your content loaded onto most Chinese mobile devices and desktops, laptops, tablets, whatever it might be, because just everything else from the West gets slowed down when it's going into China, if it's not outright banned. So the importance of having locally hosted within China, Synorbis can and others can provide that service to you. But the interesting piece with Synorbis, they also have a WeChat function where they locally host a verified account for your institution, verified WeChat account for your institution that's locally hosted in China that allows you to post content through that to Chinese audiences. Now, that's not something you're going to be able to do if WeChat's banned in the United States. So that's something that you do want to pay attention to if it's part of your, if WeChat is part of your digital strategy. Keep close tabs on what's going on here with China, because there could be some serious consequences should it get banned in the United States, not only for current Chinese students trying to communicate back home, but also for you trying to reach prospective Chinese students if you don't have an in-country version of WeChat locally hosted. So that's an important piece of the puzzle there, and certainly if the folks at Synorbis really have some great tools that can help you gain that access to the Chinese market that will help you help make a difference in these days when you're not going to be traveling to that country for some time. So that's what I have to say on the TikTok WeChat piece. But let's shift gears to broaden the scope out to the larger issues in international ed, particularly international admissions that we're facing in the United States these days. I've always been one that likes to focus on solutions wherever I've gone, developing strategic plans, identifying tools that will work in particular markets, customizing my approach to enrollment management internationally is for me a very integral part of anything I do. And looking for those solutions, particularly in trying times like these, is an important part of that puzzle. One of the places I always like to go for resources is NAFSA, not necessarily for what comes out of the national office, other than perhaps their advocacy work, which can be good but needs to be better. But when we look at the value, true value of an organization like NAFSA, I think are in the member leaders that are the ones that are doing it on the ground, that are making the tough decisions, that are trying new things, that are really experimenting with approaches and have the flexibility and backing by their institutions to make that happen. And the latest International Educator magazine that's now gone completely digital in trying times budgetarily for a lot of institutions, but also for NAFSA. They had a great article that came out in this in their August edition called Beyond Numbers, Recruitment Strategies to Changing the World. And they have in it, they interview a number of leaders in the field, one folks that I've worked with personally, including Colleen Flynn Tapalia at Clarkson University in New York, Amy Thostenson at University of Minnesota. So big and small institutions and other folks have been profiled in this article. And they cover five survival strategies for international enrollment. And I think it's worth mentioning here, and I won't go into complete depth on each of the points here, but we'll outline those for you and certainly direct you to the article that would help, I think, give a little more background on what they're actually talking about here. So the first survival strategy is starting with the incoming class. And I couldn't agree more, because those students that you've been working with for a year, that particularly in the last few months that have had the goalposts seem to have changed almost weekly in terms of what the expectations are, not only from a federal government policy, but also what you're doing on your own campuses. And I know a number of campuses have suddenly made the switch in the last couple, 3 weeks from a hybrid or an in-person model to a fully online model. Some are still in the decision-making process, and that puts your international students in a very unfavorable situation, because they are obviously facing a number of other hurdles that they have to overcome to even get here. If you are going to be having anything like a hybrid or in-person educational offering this fall, not only the visa issues that we've seen have become an issue, what Customs and Border Patrol is going to be doing might be different from what State Department guidance is at the posts where students go for their visa interviews. You could have situations where students have gone for interviews and been approved for visas because at that time your institution was either in person or going to be hybrid. And let's say they get to the border 3 weeks later, and during that time, your institution has decided to go fully online. Technically, according to the regulations as they've been put out by Customs and Border Patrol, by DHS, that student in that situation, if your institution has switched to online only in the fall, that student could be denied admission to the United States, even if they're at the airport and gotten a valid visa. Technically, because of the change that your institution made, they may not be allowed in. And you've seen several institutions reach out to their international students over the last few weeks, Johns Hopkins, Harvard, USC, when they've eventually made that switch to fully online. They said, international students, don't come. It's not worth the hassle for you this fall. But do stay with us, start online, and then we'll bring you in when we can, hopefully in the spring for the January term. So that's that incoming class. If you get this right, and if you provide the level of service, you provide a continual stream of communication to these students that you've been working with for the last few months, and they, whether they can actually get to your campus or not, whether they enroll, defer, whatever the case may be, if you get that right with them, that's going to help you down the road, because those positive experiences that hopefully that you can, positive taste in their mouths that you can leave with them, that they've had with your institution, that can be a great can provide you, your institution, a great level of success down the road, perhaps not in January, maybe next fall, that can help you rebound quicker. The next step is shift your recruitment models, recruiting models, and from a direct recruitment approach, mass college fairs, high school visit after high school visit, that might not be a reality for another year or longer. This is something that a lot of us who have recruitment tours or plan these events for institutions are coming to grips with, is that there needs to be another way, and a more consultative way of doing things makes and this kind of a shift in how we do things is making the case why you need to be absolutely flexible in what you do and have that ability to pivot quickly. And one of those pivots is number three: make the virtual pivot count. And the virtual fairs, forums, presentations, information sessions, everybody's trying them recently, and there's going to be successes, there's going to be failures, maybe more failures than successes as everybody's trying it, everybody's got Zoom fatigue and all of that. Those are realities, but the realities are, this is what the new reality we need to come to grips with. We have to do things virtually. How you do them well and provide the value in each experience you have is going to be the real key to your success in this process. Step four, working with campus partners. That's a big piece of the puzzle too. These are the folks on campus that you're working with, but it's also institutional partners that you might have abroad that you've been hoping to develop these kind of joint degree or dual degree programs or 2+2 programs with your institutional partners overseas, or 3+2 for a bachelor's master's program. All of these things should be on the table now, and ways that they can be implemented virtually, but also with a thought to the future. You now have the time. If you're not on the road, you're going to be doing some virtual recruitment, yes, but you need to be thinking a bit more broadly about how the enrollment funnel changes for you and where your sources of students are coming from, because they may not all be coming from the same sources anymore. It's very unlikely that they will. So your flexibility in this and your ability to work with campus partners, both on your campus and then external campus partners, to make it happen is really going to define your success long term. And again, part of that is looking beyond the institution, that there is a value in collaboration. And the article makes reference to Big Ten universities recently partnered together for some virtual recruitment activities. But this is also, I've talked about this before, when you look back, when there's been these kind of massive events that have happened, like 9/11, and the impact that that had on international recruitment, international education, that was the time when a lot of state consortia started forming, when I was involved in Destination Indiana, and over 20 other study consortia formed in states because they saw we need to be doing more together and not fighting amongst ourselves for students from overseas. We need to be doing more together. And that's more valuable now than it was back in 2001, 2002, when after 9/11, and we're dealing with that impact there, because you see, since that time, global competition has also ratcheted up. Canada was barely on the radar as a major destination now, but they are up there with Australia, UK now as a major threat to US's leading role in international student recruitment now. And the more we can as smaller groups within the United States to recruit as a country, Education USA has that role. Department of Commerce has a role to play there as well. But our individual states and consortia within the states, Big Ten, other types of small groups. I work with a group of Davis UWC Institute partner institutions, that 99 schools, that universities and colleges that have specific scholarships for students that come from United World College secondary schools overseas. We're working together on a virtual recruitment plan, events and follow-up events. So these are things that need to happen more in the future, not less. So if your state doesn't have a consortia, get some colleagues around you that are like-minded and have that volunteer spirit in them to commit to something like this, because this is a time when this kind of beyond your institution and the realities of your institution, that kind of thinking is absolutely essential in this day and age. So a great article coming out of NAFSA's International Educator. Certainly recommend getting some eyes on that so that you can have a look at what's going on there. Last thing that we'll talk about here is the other major news out of the past week or so has been India. India has put together, finally launched a new national education policy. First stories out of Inside Higher Ed that reflects some of the broader thinking on what India has proposed. some major thinkers there in their policy. Their reviews of it see it as a statement of intent in terms of how India is reshaping it from top to bottom, reshaping its education system. This is a long-term project, obviously. It's not happening overnight. Certain pieces will happen sooner than others, just the nature of the beast there. But on the higher ed level, the goal is to have for each district in the country to have kind of one hub university, education hub university, that will incorporate all the relative skills that you need and courses to be offered through that education hub. So as you know, might know about India's higher ed system, it's a very decentralized process. There are hundreds and hundreds of colleges, thousands of them literally around the country, and they all have affiliations with larger institutions. And a lot of the commentators have said that this new national education policy in India is you're going to see a lot of consolidation, mergers between institutions in India to get to this longer-term goal of having an education hub in each district. Not necessarily, there could be numerous districts within each state, but within India, but certainly within each district, that would be the goal. There's also the part of the policy is to open up to the top 100 universities in the world, and it doesn't say specifically what measure that's going to be coming from, but it does. It's now formalizing in policy the opportunity for foreign institutions to open up campuses in India, not to necessarily just offer a dual degree with an Indian institution, as there have been cases of those set up. A lot of institutions have offices, recruitment offices or study abroad offices in India, but not as a formal educational institutional body or physical location in India. That's not happened yet. And most of it's because national law in India has not really allowed it. So it'll be interesting to see where that goes, because the Inside Higher Ed article does mention that it's kind of been floated before that foreign institutions can come and open up shop, and there weren't any real takers yet. We'll see if that's changed and whether there is now more of an interest in making that part of the puzzle happen for India. To bring in other institutions. That's certainly something China has done successfully, but it's something that India wants to model some of that success that China's had on that front. Now, if you're looking for kind of the concrete ways that this change in India's education system and this move away from having the kind of the siloed streams in the last 4 years of education from the commerce stream, the science stream, the arts and sciences, that type of thing. There's not really the kind of divisions between them. The doors really opened up for a more broad-based liberal arts education as well. So it's really interesting to see what's happening. There's changes on the university level that will make all university degrees, four-year degrees, first degrees, bachelor's degrees, be four-year degrees. Our friends at Simple Ed have put together a nice blog piece that gives you a snapshot of what those major changes are. But certainly, I encourage you to check those out, because there's some impacts on recruitment that they cover in the Simple Ed report, and that's we'll talk about partnerships with the top 100 universities and that type of thing. And how much more realistic they'll be now with this new policy. So still a lot of unknowns about this in terms of the actual implementability of a lot of these ideas, but we'll see where that goes in the weeks and months to come. So for us here on the Roundup, this has been a really incredible week, obviously following on from our 100th anniversary last week. 100th edition last week, to continue some of the conversations. Really appreciate the feedback from longtime colleagues on LinkedIn about this project and the value it has for them in what they do. And I want to say to each of you who've watched today, thank you for being a part of the experience. Hope this has been of some value to you, and look forward to having future conversations with you down the line. So until next time, have a wonderful day. Cheers.